Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
You can't win anything with kids.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
How much are the players looking forward to Arsene Wenger arriving?
Hi guys, welcome to another episode of the Phoenix Five. Today we have a very special guest, a member of the Crazy Gang, a member of the infamous Tuesday Night Club, a former England international, a Premier League and FA Cup winner, an Arsenal legend. I could go on and on and on. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to you Mr. Nigel Winterburn. Hello, Nigel. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thank you so much again for coming on the show. Today I'm with David Graham and David Holland. Hi, guys.
How are you doing?
Hi, Paul. Hi, Nigel.
So I'm going to jump straight in, Nigel. First question we always ask the players is, what was your route into football? How did you get there? Was it YTS? Was it sending off for your CV into trying to get a club? Or was it just by a stroke of luck?
Stroke of luck, really. I was so I'm a Midlands boy, and I was playing for the Nuneaton Schools as it was then. And in one of the games, after the game, the Don Dorman, the chief scout from Birmingham City, came up to me and my parents and said, "Like, we've been watching you play. Would you be interested in coming down for a trial?" So I got a letter sent through, and then you just literally turned up. We turned up at Birmingham City training ground. There were 30 kids. I was 16 at that time. There were 30 kids, and basically we just picked two teams, and they played a game. And I was really I don't know. I played left back a little bit, but more midfield than anything else. And I was actually playing in midfield in the game where Don Dorman had watched me play. But on the day when they were picking the teams, they only had one other guy that was a regular left back. So they were asking if anyone would volunteer to play at left back. And then they said, we'll put you in your preferred position sort of later on. So I'm being left-footed and thinking, well, there's bound to be a lot of midfield players here. I'll put my hand up and take the chance, and at least I'm going to get a decent part of the game. So I played left-back for that game, and then after the game, they invited me back for another trial. And then this time they told me, you're playing left-back. And after the second trial, they offered me, what was then really an apprenticeship contract for when I left school. So I was literally 3 months from leaving school, and then signed. Obviously, I signed for Birmingham City, and really that's how it started off for me, if you like, in the professional game. I know I literally just played for my school. I played for my men's team, village team. I mean, I only lived in a very, very small village. And I basically played for a Sunday pub team. And I know there were a few scouts that had come along and watched me play, but this was really like the first opportunity, if you like, that I'd had to really join a professional team. So obviously I was delighted with that. That was the first opportunity I got. And that was my first contract, if you like, with Birmingham City as a YTS apprentice, whatever you want to call it. I got paid £12 a week, and £12 a week for my mum for petrol money. So that tells you there's a little bit of a difference in what people are getting paid today.
I don't
so that's how it started for me.
Graham?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned your school days there, Nigel, because my next question is, obviously when you are at school and you're into that, being obsessed with football, you said you were like 14, 15, 16. I'm always interested, who was your idol growing up? Watching, you know, either watching on the stands or on the television, who did you want to be like, you know?
Believe it or not, I'm a Midlands boy, but there weren't many good teams that I wanted to support in the Midlands. So I was a mad Leeds United supporter, you know, particularly through the 70s, really, Bremley, Madeley, Lorimer. That sort of era at Leeds. When,
successful period, wasn't it, for Leeds then?
Yeah, they were. I mean, they were such a fantastic footballing team, but they're also a little bit dirty as well. So I loved that period.
No way.
Watching them play. I mean, I'm a pussycat, so don't worry about that. That was a dirty team, but I latched on to Leeds United. I just don't know how it came about. Maybe, as you said, just because they were a good team and they were successful through that period. But Leeds was my team.
Do you still support them?
I still look out for their results, but I must admit, because I don't know whether I could call myself a supporter as such now, but because I played so much football, I never really went to any live games.
Yeah.
Never really had that opportunity. I'd much rather play than I would go and watch a live game. So I think when I, started sort of professionally, it sort of dipped a little bit. But I still look for the result. I still look for Leeds results. I still look for all the teams that I've been associated for. I'm still interested in how they're getting on. Maybe over other teams.
So let's start with your time at Wimbledon. As a member of the Crazy Gang, you were a four-time Player of the Year there and a vital member of the team. Tell us a bit about your time there.
Well, it's quite simple, really, because my second year at Birmingham, I got released. There were a change of manager. Jim Smith was the manager at the start of that second year, as he was when I signed for Birmingham. But then he got the sack. Ron Saunders came in and basically three quarters of the way through that season, he told almost the whole reserve team squad that, they wouldn't be retained for the following season. So literally at the end of that season, I called Jim Smith, who had then gone to Oxford, and said, look, I've been released by Birmingham. Can I come and train with you pre-season while I try and find a club? So I went to train. So that pre-season, following pre-season, I went to train with Oxford. And I'd been there, 3 weeks, I think it was. And Jim said to me, like, listen, we'll give you a six-month contract anyway, but Wimbledon are looking for a left-back. Because at that time, I think I'm right in saying that the Wimbledon players didn't get paid because of where they were coming up through the leagues. They weren't getting paid in the summer. So a lot of their players were going sort of Sweden and Norway to play. And a left back had gone to, I think it was Norway, and they got into some sort of playoffs. And he wasn't back for the pre-season for the start of the season. So Jim said that, like, obviously Wimbledon, Dave Bassett would be interested in for you to go down for a trial. So I went down there for a month. And then after that month's trial, Wimbledon wanted to sign me. So I took that opportunity and I signed for Wimbledon. So, I suppose a little bit of luck. You've got to be, you've got to put yourself out there, but you need to occasionally you need the right things to come up for you as well. So I made that transfer from Oxford to Wimbledon, and it cost Wimbledon a bottle of scotch. So I think it's maybe it was a pretty successful bottle of scotch.
Was Dave Bassett a scotch drinker then, Nigel?
No, what happened was is Jim Smith certainly was, and he loved a cigar. So we gave him a bottle of scotch as a thank you. There was no signing on fees then, let me tell you.
So Dennis Wise, John Fashanu, Wally Downs, Vinnie Jones. I mean, that's just a few of the people in that locker room. I mean, biggest prankster. One of the questions from one of the listeners was Martin. He asked, who was the biggest prankster and what was the best prank in the Wimbledon locker room?
Oh, God, I don't know about the best, but I mean, you know, it's, well, I mean, everything used to happen at Wimbledon, really, because, I mean, we trained at Richmond, sort of Roehampton. And it was literally, it was just a trucker's calf where you got chains. So there was a calf at the front, at the back was the changing rooms. But with Wimbledon, I mean, those guys were, you know, I don't know, it's just like a pub team, really. It was just hilarious. I mean, I'd always go in a tracksuit. I'd never take anything else in with me because you'd get, you know, your shoes would get pinned to the ground. They would, you know, your clothes would get cut up. We used to play British Bulldog on a Friday. Dave Bassett used to name the team on a Friday. So you knew if you weren't in the team, it was your honour to try and get someone injured so you could get into the team. So I'm not sure if ever the team that got selected on the Friday was the team, the 11 players that actually started on the Saturday. But, I mean, those guys just got up to, you know, everything, really. It's just little pranks. They weren't, you know, they don't sound stupid or anything. You know, maybe if you're misbehaving or whatever, you get tied up to the tree, you wouldn't have a lot of clothes on, but yeah, there was just different things. Algae pan in your boxer shorts was one of the favorite ones. So yeah, there was quite a lot going on. But I mean, we just had such a fantastic time because we scared a lot of teams with our approach, with the way we were coming up through the leagues, really. So, I mean, it was, yeah, there was, we used to stop off at the pub on the way back from away games. You know, we used to then get dropped off at the Wimbledon ground, which on a Saturday was a nightclub. So you can imagine what was happening then. So I think it was a completely different culture, if I'm honest, to what it's like now. And we would never get away with what we did then, but yeah, it was just, I don't know, really, it was just a dream to be part of that. But it was, when you look at it, it was slightly wacky as well.
I don't know if it's a bit of a cliche, but the old when you was at Wimbledon, you know, the pump the ball to the big man up front and hope for the best, was that a myth, or was it as straightforward as that? Because that's the thing people got with Wimbledon from back in the day, that it was just basic kick and rush. So if it was a thing, a lot of teams should have maybe done it, you know. So what was the tactics like? Because it did seem like that back in the late 80s, early 90s, you know.
I think kick and rush is probably too technical for us. if I'm honest. No, what we used to do is, I mean, you could call it long ball, you could call it kick and rush, you could call it what you want. But they had a statistician that they used to work on how many times you lost the ball in your own half, how many times you got the ball into the final third, and he used to break all that down, goals conceded, goals scored from positions. So basically, you're probably right. We played longer balls from our own half, but we played them down into the channels or into the centre forward. And anything over the halfway line, really we could try and be as creative as we wanted to be. But the main aim was, at the end of all that, was crosses into the box. And it was always...
I was going to say, it did seem very effective at the time. That's what I mean. I mean, look, when you see the formations of the way teams play now, I know it's a different era, but it did seem very effective. You know, when you did play Wimbledon, when a team, you know, there was like, oh, we've got Wimbledon today. it's going to be a hard game. But when you think of the way they play, do you think?
Well, I think we were physical. We did have a fairly big and strong team with a lot of big characters. I think we just frightened teams really before we started the games. Nobody really wanted to play us because, as you say, they knew they were in for quite a physical game. Listen, we took a few wallopings along the way, but the best thing about that team was it was just literally forgotten there and then.
Yeah.
And then we came again next week. I mean, I think I can remember one of the seasons we came up, I think we got beat two or three times by five or six, but we still got promoted. I mean, it was just ridiculous how much belief that we had in what we were going to do. So, yeah, if you like, I mean, I'm quite happy to call it kick and rush. It's quite a polite way of putting it for us, if you like. But, we were just very, very effective at what we did. And we were a long ball team. But I'd say to you, that was out of stats, really. You know, anyone thinks that stats have just come out. Well, the stats are just different to what they did when I played. But they had someone that worked on that all the time, and where, you know, used to analyze other teams and where most goals were scored, and we were almost trying to replicate that and get the balls into those areas as quick as possible and as much as we could throughout the 90 minutes. And that was how simple the Wimbledon game was.
So in 1987, you get a move to Arsenal. So you won most of your honours under George Graham. Looking back at your career, your most successful period as a and trophies was under George Graham at Arsenal. And then obviously in 96, Wenger came in. What was the feeling in the squad when he came in? Because obviously you had Bruce Rioch in between for a short period. Then Wenger comes in, who's an unknown manager at the time. Mm-hmm. Very different to what the Premier League knew at that stage. What was the first reaction in the locker room prior to Wenger coming in? But here,
David Dean had made the announcement that Arsene Wenger was coming in, and I think you'll know from all the press as well is nobody really knew who Arsene Wenger was. But I think when you meet the man, I've said on many, many occasions, I think when I did the first one, a maximum of two training sessions, I just knew that I needed to be part of his squad, really, because it was just so different. It was short, it was sharp, it was intense. And if you went through into the pre-seasons, he was so ahead of his time because everything was on a stopwatch. Distances that you were covered in pre-season for running, the older players would get a different amount of time to complete those running sessions. So the old idea was that everybody, no matter what, whether you were 18 or whether you were 38, the idea was that everybody was working at, if he wanted you to be working at 80%, everybody was working at 80%. If it was 90 or 100, everybody would be at 90 and 100. So you used to adjust your running times. But then at times as well, you wouldn't just be doing out and out running. You would be doing fitness work with the ball. If you were a defender, it would be, collecting the ball, passing it into midfield, continuing with your run and crossing. So it was just so different to anything else that I'd done throughout my career. And I think it just showed in his, in his style of play. He basically, when he came in, I think he brought in quality players, midfield and forwards, and he worked on the advanced, if you like, game, passing and movement, combination play, and he just let us organise ourselves defensively to go out and play. So he was just saying to you, basically, have no fear, just go out and enjoy yourself. It was just, when you're getting into your later years like I am, it was just like, oh, here we go, this is happy day. So it was a great time to be at Arsenal. It was just completely different to any other manager that I'd really worked under before.
But did everyone buy into it when Wenger first turned up? Was there people a bit 50-50 about these methods? Because obviously no one had ever seen it before.
No, I think everyone just felt it was, they were just being freed up, if you like, because George Graham was sensational at organisation and discipline. And it was almost so. I mean, we should never forget that period. I mean, he was amazing at what he did. But it was also, once you've done that for a while, then you try something else. Bruce Rioch for me just completely didn't work. He's just a manager that I think I really didn't understand what he really wanted. But when Arsene Wenger came, it was just a whole different, you know, it was as if the light switched back on and the hunger was there and you just went again. I don't know anybody that disliked what Arsene Wenger was doing, you know. And I think testament to the man is that, have you ever heard of anyone slagging him off when they left?
Nah.
I mean, you know. Eventually I left and was moved on, but... you know, I didn't have a bad word to say about Arsene Wenger, and you know, and I still don't. He was incredible in that early period with the way that he treated players and the quality of player that he brought to the football club.
Obviously, the foundation was there because you played in the most famous back five of Premier League or any English football. In my eyes, it was the best back five ever, and I'm sure many people will agree. But that gave the license for obviously Wenger to come in and play a more expansive type of football because the foundation was already there, bought by George Graham.
Yes, to a degree, you're right. But there was a big rumour going around that several members of the staff had told him that he would need to disband the back four. He thought that he was told that they were getting too old. But I think he made his own judgment through training. And games. So I suppose in a way you may be right, but in a little way slightly wrong as well, because he was his own man. I think he would make it, well, he is his own man. He makes his own decisions. He doesn't take orders from anybody. So he made his own decisions to keep that back four once he realised the intensity that we had, the togetherness that we had. And you're right, I think he used that to then develop the attacking side of the game, which I have to say he did, you know, he did brilliantly with the players that he brought in.
We did a podcast earlier on in the season about Arsenal versus United, the rivalry period. Mm. And I think that George Graham's period was very successful. It's underrated in terms of what he achieved at the time. I think Wenger came in with and did create a different style of football and brought the continent to England. And as you said about the drinking culture, all those things kind of changed. But do you think he underachieved over his period, Wenger, compared to what Graham achieved in his period? You won one league title under Wenger, obviously over a long period. But do you think he had two halves of his career? He had a very good start with you guys, then got to the Invincibles, and it seemed to wane quite quickly after that. What's your opinion working with both men?
If you look at George Graham, he rebuilt Arsenal. If you like, he got rid of most of the senior players. So again, he brought in players, younger players, hungry players that he wanted to work with and the system that he wanted to do. And as I said to you, it's quite regimented. He had, but his organisation was absolutely sensational. I would have said at the time that nobody, not even the diehard Arsenal supporters of those seasons of 89 and 91 would have said, we were anywhere near favourites to win the league titles that season because we were a relatively new team. So I think, you know, George Graham, if you like, I call it what I used to call then the modern times for Arsenal, started to recreate the success. But in terms of style and also being very, very successful, I think, you know, Arsene Wenger was successful up to 06, which was coincided with moving to the new stadium as well. Was also, you know, I retired in 03, but even when I left in 2000, I think it was a sensational period to be part of the football club, not only as a player, but also as a supporter as well. You know, lost the Champions League final in that season, but... You know, it was still a massive achievement to get there. But everything that Arsene Wenger had provided up to that period was sensational. And you know, I think they're both managers, different styles, but one started it, if you like, and the other manager took over in Arsene Wenger, and up to 06, it looked as if Arsenal were just going to keep ploughing forward and be the team that was going to be the team that was going to take on what, if you like, the elite of Europe. But the one disappointment for me in Arsene Wenger's team is I thought we had the quality, but we never really delivered in Europe. And that would be my one big regret. And I can't answer that question as to why we didn't do that. But no, I think to answer your question, I think Arsene Wenger's first period, if you like, to 06, was incredible. And then I have my own thoughts on what went wrong from there, because they moved to the new stadium and it almost seems as if it started to fall apart gradually from there on in. And if you look at the players that they had before they moved to the Emirates and then after that, I don't think there is many player that I could think of that would get in. There's a few that would get into the squad and be part of, let's say, the 89, 91 and 98 teams. But, you know, a lot of those teams from 06 onwards didn't rival any of those teams for pure belief, consistency and deliverance of titles. It just started to go backwards for Arsenal.
It all started to spiral when David Dean left.
Yes.
Just about to say the same thing.
Yeah. I think so. David Dean, listen, he was around all the time. He was around the training ground, but he wasn't in your way, if that made sense. So he was keeping an eye on what was going on, but it didn't feel as if he was interfering. You know, he knew his job. I think he was heavily involved in some of the transfers that Arsene Wenger wanted. So, it appears that it's, you know, David Dean leaving was, if you like, one of the reasons why I think maybe the club took a different route. But, you know, these things happen. And you just have to deal with it and move on.
Do you think that Wenger should have left slightly sooner? So because the board, there's obviously some problem between the board and Wenger at some stage, whether it's he didn't want to spend the money or the board didn't want to give him the money or what it would be. Do you think they needed a new manager to come in and say?
I think he had a love affair with Arsenal, and I think that's why you find that he's not taking another job in a Premier League. And I think he's very disappointed with the way that he left. And I'm sure he's got a lot of stories that a lot of people would love to know with regards to restrictions that he had on spending when they moved to the new stadium. I think it's divided, really. I think even with his teams, the standard had slipped. But then I would say to you, and a lot of people blame Arsene Wenger for that. I mean, I personally don't. But if you look what he did, you know, continue to get us inside the top four, which personally I don't think is an achievement. You know, I want to see my team going for titles. So it's not all about just finishing inside the top four, but if you're running a club as a business, it is because the Champions League money is so important to them. And you look where we are now, I think in a way it still shows what a good job Arsene Wenger was doing, because, you know, the managers since then have found it very, very difficult to even get into the top four.
Yeah.
So, listen, I think a lot of people, I do a lot of work at the club on match days. I listen to a lot of people. A lot of people say he stayed too long. Maybe he did. But a lot of people blame him for what's going on. I certainly don't blame him for what's going on, because the board can make those decisions. I actually think that the board sat there, and while Arsene Wenger was keeping them in the top four, they were completely happy. So, you know, maybe they needed to look at a different direction earlier and saying, you know, oh, this is great, but we want to be back to what we were doing, which is challenging for titles. But, you know, I if I'm honest with you, I just don't know with this board what they really want from my football club. It's quite bewildering at times.
The Man United Arsenal rivalry, and we could do a whole week on these games, but obviously we haven't got all day. Some would argue, and myself included, it was you and Brian McClair that was the real start of the great rivalry. When you take out Dennis Irwin with a tackle, and then it erupts. And then from that moment up until about 2006, that was the biggest rivalry in English football, and if not in European football, for the amount of moments that those games had.
Well, I think from Arsenal supporters, I'm loved. And from Man United supporters, I'm hated. So, I mean, it actually started a little bit before, because we had the cup game against Man United at Highbury, and Brian McClair missed the penalty, which I said something to. I can't even remember what I said, if I'm quite honest, after he missed. And that was, I've always said to me, you know, you shouldn't be, you know, I shouldn't get involved in those things. But occasionally, I did, and it all sort of kicked off from there. And then the one that most people remember is obviously the tackle on the Brian McClair incident. But I also feel as well is that we felt that we were the team that felt that Man United were going to be one of our big rivals, and it proved that going forward. And those two teams were like two juggernauts going head to head. Both believed they could beat each other. Both were not going to give an inch. And a lot of time, those games turned out to be crucial games. So the slightest incident turned out to be more major than maybe what it should be. But, I absolutely loved them. You can tell by the smile on my face. That's what football's all about. It's putting yourself in situations, believing you're the best, wanting to play against the best. And along that period of time, I think if you like 89 and early sort of 90s, Liverpool were probably the team, but then Manchester United, for me, as I remember, it started to be the team that really, if we want to be the best, we're going to have to overtake. And they were, I think, throughout my career, Manchester United were the benchmark. And along the way, Arsenal managed to knock them off the top of the crown on occasions. And that's why I believe those games were so explosive. And I'm not the only one to be involved with Man United, because Cesc Fabregas is very good at throwing pizzas. So, I'm not my only one. And, I think for me, the iconic moment out of all this, the bit I remember best was watching, is Arsene Wenger standing on the dugout at Old Trafford with his arms aloft. So I think it just shows you the intense and the rivalry between the two teams. But yeah, if you want to blame me like the rest of the Man United supporters and Sir Alex, then I think I'm old enough and big enough to take that.
What was your personal favourite Man United Arsenal game that you played in?
I mean, if you had to pick one, when we beat you at Old Trafford in March 98, the run we were on, which we thought set us up to win the title, because we knew we couldn't lose that game to you. I just love those games because they were so intense. You know, they were 22 great players going head to head, and not one of those players would give an inch, and they all believed that their team was going to win, and that's what made them so epic and so fascinating, and why I think a lot of other people, apart from Man United and Arsenal supporters, wanted to watch them, because they realised that something might happen. They're quite explosive within those games as well. They were. I couldn't pick out really. I wouldn't like to pick out one game, but I suppose from an Arsenal point of view, the March game would be pivotal in us winning the double in 98, and for yourselves beating us in the semi-final with Giggs's goal was what Manchester United supporters will remember. But those games were just so intense and so brutal at times. It was just but. You can see I'm smiling as I'm talking about it. So they were just a pleasure to play in.
At Arsenal, who was the best player in training?
Well, I never worried about who was best in training. But Bergkamp was the pinnacle for me to play with on a match day. Listen, I've seen some good players in training. So you put them on a pitch and they fall apart because you haven't got 70 to 100,000 fans watching you if you get to a final. But Bergkamp was just absolutely incredible. Just the way that he conducted himself, but his ability just spoke for itself. But his appreciation of players around him was just immense.
Yeah.
And I put him down as my all-time greatest Arsenal player that I've played with, and solely because I only played for a year with Thierry. And Thierry wasn't the player that he turned out to be in that first season. And I think when I left Arsenal, he then sort of came alive sort of thing. And for watching somebody, I'd put Henri up there with Bergkamp. But playing with Bergkamp was just like living in a different world.
Also, going back a bit further, obviously, you playing left back, you had Mark Overmars in front of you.
Yeah.
But before Overmars came, as a child, I remember a certain Dutch player coming over called Glenn Helder.
Yeah.
I remember there was a bit of a rave review about him being the next best thing. What I'd like to know is, what was he like? I mean, what happened to him? I remember him playing like one good game in 10. I mean, he was supposed to be technically very good. We spoke to Brian Dean about Thomas Brolin when he came over, and it obviously didn't work for him. Was that the same sort of thing with Glenn Helder? Because he was quite disappointing in the end, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I think the maybe the culture and the intensity of the games was maybe too much for him at the time.
Okay.
He came over. I don't say if he was arrogant, but maybe a little bit he might have came over that way. And I'm not sure he really wanted to. I don't think he really understood the Arsenal way and fitted into that. I think we didn't really fall out, Glenn and myself, but I think we had a bit of a difficulty in knowing what each other wanted.
Yeah.
I think he thought he was in the team just to, it seems a bit crazy really, but with George Graham, you know, the wingers had to provide going forward, but they also had to be alive to come and sit back in.
Selfish, basically. Sorry, Nigel. Selfish play, would you say?
Yeah, a little bit. And he was, I remember we did one training game and he had a little mazy run. He put a cross in. And then he just walked back and I just sort of looked at him and said, you know, that's not gonna work here. You're not just gonna get away with that. And I think he just sort of looked at me as if to say, you know, who do you think you're talking to? Mm. And it was just, I think there was, you know, we didn't really have a falling out, but I would say that he wasn't someone that I really got along with in terms of playing styles. Yeah. I never felt that we both were covering each other's back. I just felt that he was looking at one side of the game, whereas we'd all been brought up on both sides, defence and attack. And I don't think really he was tuned into that, or whether he really wanted to do that too much, if I'm honest with you.
Yeah, so nice. What was the dressing room like in like a North London derby or a big Man United game? Like, Wenger's known for being cool and calm, but was the dressing room fired up before you went out, or did he like to keep everyone calm?
Yeah, I mean, like the intensity of the Man United games, because I think the challenges that were ahead of you, but the North London derby was completely different, because I always call that a game for the fans, a game you must not lose. You know, you're thinking about if it was traditionally played on a Saturday, if you lost, then Sunday and then Monday you had to go back to work. So, you know, your supporters wouldn't want to really go back to work. So for me, the North London derby was so intense, but it was more intense for the supporters. And you had to do absolutely everything that you could to make sure that you know, they were smiling and happy after the game, and they could go into work on a Monday morning and not make up some excuse for not going in. But yeah, I think the intensity to start with of the North London derby was, I've never seen anything like it. It was just incredible.
Yeah, that happened to me today, because I thought we were going to pip Tottenham to seventh yesterday when they were 1-0 down to Leicester. And then Tottenham gone 1-4-2. So they went ahead of us. I had to go into work. My boss is a Tottenham fan. He was griefing me today.
Yeah, see, I get that. And but I'm a little bit more like, I don't know what it is. What is this cup?
Europa Conference League.
I mean, to be quite honest with you, you should never ever really say this, but I think personally, if Mikel Arteta stays in charge, and I hope he does, then I think it will help him with the training that he can do with the squad to get his ways over to the team. Because if you think about the intensity of this season, those guys would have never really had a lot of time to train. It would have all just been recovery and preparation for the next game. It's the pre-season and working in the week that he will have now will really tell us what Mikel Arteta, I believe what Mikel Arteta is all about. Listen, I always want my club to be in Europe. But I think in terms of development for Mikel Arteta, and I hope he's still there, and I hope we get a number of changes to the squad, I think that's going to be so, so crucial for us next season.
Famous Arsenal Tuesday club.
It's very, very difficult, because I'm not a great sort of storyteller. I wasn't a regular member of the Tuesday club. But what used to happen was that so if we didn't have a game in the week, we used to do, with George Graham, we used to do fitness session at Highbury around the pitch, up the terracing, or, you know, up the terracing to start with before it changed to all-seater. And then we used to go into and do an indoor area. We used to have a 5 or 6-a-side competition. We were almost finished by 12:30. On a Tuesday. So then everybody, and almost everybody then, used to either get a taxi in or used to get the train into Arsenal, to Highbury. And then from there, we all used to arrange to go out. So, I mean, from my memories, is there was a fair amount of players going out each week. And then we'd go out and we'd just go TGI's and have light lunch or something with a few beers. And then everybody would just start dispersing to wherever they wanted to go. So, you know, different players wouldn't want to stay out. They'd want to go and do different things. So everybody would just sort of mix and disperse and do really what they wanted to do. Some were gone by 10 o'clock, some were still there at 6 o'clock in the morning. So it was just a bit of a free for all. But the one thing I will say about all that is it gave us a fantastic team spirit. And what happened was George Graham started to get, wind of that something was happening. And he couldn't quite work out what was going on. So what he used to do is he employed his assistant, Stuart Hewson, to be detective. So the lads had gone out one day, and they'd actually gone this time. They hadn't gone into town. I think they'd gone into Potter's Bar, into a wine bar in Potter's Bar. And so they've been having a few drinks. And then all of a sudden, it was quite a cold day, and the window was sort of frosted up. And they could just see this bloke outside wiping the window and trying to peer inside. And then they realised that it was Stuart Houston, the assistant manager. So the lads went and grabbed him and dragged him inside and then got him a beer. And then, of course, obviously he was there for George. George was very, very strict. He was quite a disciplinarian. So anyway, he had a beer and that, and he just said to the lads, "I'll just tell George that I couldn't find you. And we'll just have to, you know, we'll just make out." That was because he knew he was going to be in the shit as well. one of the lads would grass you up. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't anything specific that was funny that would happen from those nights out. It was just that it was named the Tuesday Club. And I suppose, if you like, the so-called members, Steve Bond, Merce, Tony Adams, to name three, were probably the biggest drinkers out of that group. So you just had to negotiate your way around those three and try and slip away if you didn't really want to get caught off in a lot of heavy drinking. But as I said to you, for me, it gave us a great team building exercise, if you like, camaraderie. But yeah, I mean, but we didn't have a game. We were never in on the Wednesday after. So you could recover on the Wednesday. You were back in training on the Thursday. And then I thought none of the lads were drinking after that. But now we find out from Tony that I think he was drinking all the time. So I don't think it was just I think it was Monday to Friday club for him. Don't think it was just a Tuesday club. But yeah, I mean, it's just something that we did out of habit, if you like. But it just gave us that togetherness. If I'm honest with you, I think a lot of other teams were doing the same thing. We weren't doing anything that none of the other, because I don't believe we would have been able to survive if we were the only team doing that. And then when you talk to players that played around your era now when they're retired, they all say they were going out and drinking X amount of pints. So yeah, you were just all, that was the culture of football around that time.
Yeah. Just briefly sticking with the drinking culture, I read an article, done a bit of research, and you went on Arsenal at the time, you went on a pre-season tour to Austria. Now, this intrigued me a little bit. After the games you played, apparently yourself and the rest of the English lads went out drinking, where some of the foreign lads were going to cafes, drinking coffee and smoking untold cigarettes. Is that true?
Yeah.
I don't get the smoking thing, because to me, that's worse.
Well, yeah. I'm trying to think of who the players were smoked, but some of the guys, I mean, they just, the foreign guys couldn't believe what we were doing. But I mean, we weren't under, to be quite honest with you, with Arsene Wenger, it wasn't like with George Graham, we weren't drinking the amount. Arsene Wenger just gave us a respect. He never really set any rules. You know, if he didn't want you to do something, it would just be taken away. Like, so, you know, as soon as the thing came out with Tony, and then he understood what was going on. So he didn't open he closed the players' bar after the game.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, he just tried to change the culture.
But, did he get rid of the ashtrays as well?
it's hard to get rid of an ashtray in the dressing room toilets, let me tell you. listen, it's just, to be quite honest, Arsene Wenger just trusted you. I mean, we'd go on pre-season training and we'd do a lot of training. And once we finished, well, sometimes we did three training sessions in a day. Once we'd finished the training sessions, if you wanted to, you know, to go for a walk and have a beer later on in the evening, you were never told you can't do that. But I think his method was on, you know, if you're going to start down in 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 pints, then you're going to be infecting your teammates around you. And that's really what he worked on, respect for each other over anything else. But you're right. Yeah. We would sometimes go out and grab a beer, and you know, some of the other guys, the French guys and that, would go and grab a coffee and smoke a cigarette. But I mean,
caffeine and tobacco. Just, yeah,
it's just the way it was.
Do you think that with obviously the changing coming in at the back end of your career, you started to see the more foreign influences coming in? Was that a clear in the locker room, a clear divide quite quickly? As you were saying, again, on a Tuesday night, those players wouldn't necessarily come in. Did it harm the team bond at all?
No, I think they completely understood. I mean, they were, I think if you talk to Thierry Henry, he talks about how once he joined training and was around the club, the passion that the English players had for their club. So, no, I mean, are you talking about, you're talking about different cultures. You're accepting their culture. Listen, we're all like comfy blankets. We rather associate and be with people that we're more comfortable with rather than try and integrate, I think, into, you know, a different culture. But the French guys that came in, you know, we mixed and we did talk, but obviously if they went out, they would probably be more together than with us. But the most important thing was is when we were on the pitch. And when we were on the pitch, we were definitely all together. There was no doubt about that, because if one player didn't think he was together, he'd be told pretty quickly what he needed to do to fit in. So there was no divide. If you like, there was a difference in culture and what we did, but once we were focusing on the game, we were together as one unit. There was never any discrepancies.
Did you find you tried to corrupt some of the foreign players when they come in? You know, you had the Tuesday night club, the Wednesday night club, the Thursday night club. Was there any people that come on you thought, right, we spoke to our players and they got taken under the wing? So Stephen Henshaw was taken under the wing by Colin Hendry and corrupted to our English ways. Was there anyone that came to your club and you thought, we'll take him under our wing? And it was,
well, there was no need to, because Gilles Grimaldi was straight in there. He loved it. I think he was English. But I mean, no, we didn't need to, really. And then you get the role reversal of that. I remember when Jermaine Pennant joined us. I think he was 16 when he first joined us, and he went and sat at the back of the coach. And Pat Wright's just literally grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and led him to the back of the coach and said, you get to sit up to there when you've played 150 games for Arsenal. You don't get to sit back. You don't get to sit up there with those guys. So you get a role reversal. But I think the one that, you know, really fit in straight away was Gilles Grimaldi, because, yeah, I think he was an Englishman really anyway, if I'm honest with you.
Nigel, we were talking about in another pod a couple of weeks ago about the FA Cup and things that we miss from the FA Cup. The old football songs. Obviously, you was involved in the old Hot Stuff one. And how often do you play that in your car now?
I've got it on my phone still. Well, the best thing about that is if you're talking about the one where they did the video of that with Paul Davis dancing. I mean, that was the best video come song that I ever remember. I mean, literally, they just plied us with lager before that. And then we did that. And then they wanted someone to do a solo dance. And Davo was the one that got volunteered or volunteered. And it was just, I mean, you can imagine when you've had a few beers, I mean, and you're sitting there watching someone doing that. I mean, the lads were just in stitches. But some of those things were, I mean, it's just different to do as a group. I mean, a lot of time we weren't really, to be quite honest, that bothered whether we did those sort of songs or not. But if they got you to go, it involved having a few beers along the way. So I suppose the lads just, they would be happy with that. But put yourself forward to dance or sing certainly wasn't high on my recommendation of list to do. That's for sure. That's probably why you see any of those videos. You'll see me hiding away at the back, particularly if you hear my voice trying to sing as well.
Oh, so you're not going to give us a sing song now?
I'd love to, but unfortunately, I'm running out of time.
worst dressed player at Arsenal when you was there? Who came in with the most hilarious gear, and who had control of the music?
Music was very, very different because started to you imagine we started to bring music into the dressing room. So anybody really wanted to. I'm not musical at all, if you're honest. So you know, I'm a bit more into easy listening music, if I'm honest. But so all the different players used to bring in different different bits of music. I'm just trying to think of dressing. I mean, if you look back at some of the clothing we had in that period of time, I mean, it was pretty naff, wasn't it? If you look back, I think we were all, I don't know, I'm trying to just think. I mean, when I went to West Ham, obviously Paolo Di Canio was, I mean, he was pucker. I mean, he just looked like he was going out every single day he came into to training. I don't know who he was sponsored by, but all those Italian gear that he had on, I mean, he just looked $1 million every single time. So I wouldn't mind being of having his tailor to sort me out through the week as well. But I don't know. I can't really remember who was sort of in control of the music. I think different players like Mickey Thomas, I think Dave Rocastle at that period of time were bringing in little bits of stuff along the way as well. And I'm just trying to think who it was. Do you know what? If I'm honest with you, I can't even remember who it was with when Arsene Wenger came in. Who brought the music in? There's no way it'd be Ray Parlour, that's for sure.
Dean, you've mentioned West Ham there, Nigel, and you've mentioned Paolo Di Canio, so I think you know what's coming next. You said in previous interviews that you didn't have any issues with him. Obviously, you ended up playing with him. But the actual Sheffield Wednesday Arsenal game, when you approached him, what happened? I mean, what was going through your mind as he was let going off the pitch? You went towards him. Well, I was asking, you take it from there, please.
I was asking if he'd get the shower ready for me. and I don't think he was too happy with that. And then for a split second, I mean, I have to admit, I thought, yeah, you're going to get smacked here. So I thought he was going to smack me. So no normal person, unless you are 6'6" and built like a brick lighthouse, you're not just going to stand there. So I would probably describe myself as I like to light the fuse paper a few times, but get to the back as quick as I could. But unfortunately, I was on my own on that occasion. And listen, I thought he was going to hit me. And I just ducked out the way, and nothing came. But I mean, people mentioned.
I bet you're sick of that question, to be fair, aren't you?
Well, yes and no, because I mean, I get a lot of stuff. I mean, if people get narky with me, they always bring that up occasionally and they expect me to react to it. But to tell you what, I've watched it loads of times. I watched it with my daughter loads of times, and we're always laughing and wetting ourselves about, you know, what I did. So it's, listen, I always say you got to laugh at yourself. It's something I shouldn't have really got involved in, but I did. And yes, I thought I was going to get a smack. And being 5'8" and about 11 stone at that time, there was no way I was going to stand there. So I ducked out the way. I thought I ducked out the way pretty well, to be honest with you. But as I said on many occasions, you've probably seen it, that
it's brilliant.
When I went to West Ham, I've got on so well with Paolo. But within football, he's such an intense guy. So I didn't have any problems with him at all.
What was he like to train with compared to someone like Bergkamp?
Well, I talked about this the other week, actually, about he's a fantastic player. But what I always ask him, you know, he says he turned down a move to, I found out when we were doing the interview with somebody else the other week, saying that he reckons in his book, he says he turned down Manchester United. And because that would have been my question to him, would be, why did you not go to one of the big clubs? Because he had that ability.
But
he was very, very intense in training. If anybody was messing around, he hated it. many, well, not the same many occasions, that's wrong, but on a few occasions when I was at West Ham, he would just walk off training, go in, get a shower, blue Ferrari was out the drive, and then he'd come back the next morning as if nothing had happened. And the first time it happened, I was like looking at the lads and going, what's happening? And he's just like, oh, he does it all the time. He'll be back in the morning. It's all right. And then he'd just disappear. And he would. He'd be back in the morning. Everybody would be his best friend again. And then he'd start training. But he just didn't like certain training sessions. If he wasn't happy, he wasn't staying there. He was off. He was gone. And he said, oh, he'd rant in Italian. I think he was probably saying, you're wasting my time and I need to go and get a new suit. And he was off. And you'd see him. you'd still be at training. You'd see his car disappear down the drive and he'd be gone.
Yeah, no, I can't have this interview and not ask. I've obviously been an Arsenal fan. I've got fabulous goals that I can remember. We've got to talk about your goal against Chelsea.
Petit went in very bravely and very powerfully. Vieira. Winterberg. Oh, what a goal! Nigel Winterburn.
Unbelievable. When you just let it rip and it's gone top corner. How was your feeling after that?
Well, if you keep running that clip, I think you'll find that I put my foot straight through the hoarding board. So that probably tells you what I felt about it. To be quite honest, I didn't realise it was so late. And if you watch that clip back, Dennis Wise gets body checked, I think, by Manu Petit. Because I was actually looking at that time to make the pass. And then I see Dennis Wise slip over. So I just took it forward. And then when I took it forward, I just knew I was just going to hit it. And it's just one of those things that when you hit, sometimes you know it's going in. Mm. And once I hit it, I knew it was going in. So yes, a few Chelsea supporters mentioned it to me, so it brings a smile to my face. And each year that I get asked about it, it just edges a yard back. So I think we're up to about 40 yards at the moment. And actually, it was probably about 22 or 23 yards out. So every year someone mentions it, it just edges that little bit further out. But one of the, it's probably not funny for you guys, but we got asked by a TV company to go to the Arsenal training ground and recreate goals that you'd scored. And they tried to get me to recreate the Chelsea goal. I've got a bad ankle. And I'm talking about a few years ago. And I couldn't even kick the ball 23 yards. And we're trying to replicate this goal. I think I ended up at the end hitting it from about 16 yards out to try and replicate this goal. I mean, it's just ridiculous. The power that you lose when you retire from when you're playing so quickly is incredible. But yes, thank you very much. I agree with you. It was a fantastic goal.
England, we can't not talk about the two England caps against Italy and Germany. And we've asked players about maybe having more caps or, you know, we understand everyone appreciates the caps that they got. And we always intrigued. We had an underrated 11 team from the 90s and your name was one of the players that came up. And one of the lads who's not here today based it on not enough England caps. What was your time in England like? And do you think that, not deserved, because a lot of players haven't liked the word deserved, but do you think he was overlooked a little bit too much over that period and Stuart Pearce was like a shoo-in because he was Stuart Pearce?
Do I think I was overlooked? Well, if I'm arrogant, then I'll say yes. But I think, listen, I played with Stuart at West Ham, so, and I watched him play. He's a terrific player. I think my biggest problem were, if you like, the team that I was playing at Arsenal at that time, winning the titles, and we were super competitive. And I think I was being overlooked, almost as like a backup, really. And I've got to admit to you is we won the league in 89 and 91. I don't think after that I ever looked at an England squad because I believed a lot of time I wasn't going to get in. I got in for those two caps, you're right, and I am so super proud of getting them against two fantastic teams as well. But do you know what? If you'd have asked me when I was playing, I didn't even know half the time what day those squads were being announced. And certainly I knew for myself that I wasn't going to be in them the majority of the time. Yes, I got in on a few occasions. Did I like it? No. I felt it was so clicky, and I wasn't super confident being around players that I didn't know. It wasn't a comfortable environment for me. And the one thing I've said is I just wish I could have started and played 90 minutes just to show whoever was in charge at that period of time whether I was good enough to be part of the squad or I wasn't. But yeah, I felt I was being overlooked, and I didn't know why. I never asked the question because...
Did Wenger ever say to you?
No, nothing at all. I don't think he sort of needed to. And I've no idea if Wenger spoke to any of the England managers at that period of time. But, you know, that didn't sort of worry me if I'm honest, because in one way I wanted to get that opportunity, but in another way it was a bit of relief because I wasn't put in a situation that I was totally uncomfortable with, and I did feel it was very, very clicky. And I'm sure Rio Ferdinand did an interview not that long ago where he said he felt it was very, very clicky as well.
Yeah, like Liverpool, Arsenal, Man United players, Chelsea.
I could sort of understand that because that was the big rivalry. You know, you could have been playing against those guys on the Saturday, or you could be playing against them on the following Saturday. You're coming back, but then you've got to try and gel as a team for England as well. So it's not something that I really worried about, if I'm honest. I knew I was doing everything I could for my club. I was being picked regularly for my club, which was Arsenal at that period of time. And if I couldn't get it in, I just stopped worrying about it. I didn't even, as I said to you, reiterate what I was just saying. I didn't even look at the squads. I didn't even know when they were coming out. The only difference you noticed was that, you know, a lot of people would disappear and you ended up, in that period of time, well, everybody was away with their national teams, that you ended up usually training with the kids, and that was the only difference, really. But it wasn't to be. But I'll take the two I got because of the two teams I played against. But there was a little bit of frustration from my point of view that I just didn't get to play 90 minutes. But Stuart Pearce, I would never be disrespectful to, because somebody who gets that amount of caps. And I've watched play, and he was a sensational player. But I just couldn't work out on a periods of times, you know, why I wasn't called up, and if I was almost, if you like a backup. But that's the way it goes. So
Very honest, Nigel. So appreciate that. I was saying on the WhatsApp groups the lads the other day, I didn't realise when I was doing some research for the show that the best back five in English football, arguably, who are all English, never represented their country as a back five, which it just seems, when you think about it in literal terms, bonkers, when you could go, well, there's my back five for every game that they're fit, and I'll work on the rest going up the field. That's, I mean, anyone else want to say anything about the England at that point? I just still find it bizarre now speaking about it.
Well, personally, I find it bizarre that I think one of the managers didn't have the courage to do that.
Nigel, that's a good point. But do you think either Graham or Wenger would have allowed that because of injuries?
Yeah, oh, yeah, they would. You know, if you're picked for your national team, you go. You want to be part of your national team. I mean, certain managers might say, "Oh, with the workload, you know, maybe are you okay with going?" But I don't know many players, if any, that wouldn't want to go with their national team. I put it more down to the England managers, and they could say, oh yeah, but I didn't think these, you know, individually this player is better than this player. I have no argument with that whatsoever. You can't dispute that because it's somebody's opinion. What I'm saying is I am surprised that one of those England managers was not brave enough to select that back four for one friendly game. and then just picked everybody else around them and just see how it worked. Listen, it may not have worked. It didn't work for us in Europe for Arsenal, so it may not have worked. But yes, Brett, it's a good point. But it's what it is. And I just move on and sweep it away very, very quickly.
Compared to England caps now, I mean, if you was playing the modern day now, you probably have 30, 40 caps because they're given away now. It's not willingly, because that's the wrong maybe word. Everyone deserves it to a point, but they're more frivolously given away. Whereas you look back, when we've done the 90s underrated team, was based on caps. Steve Bruce, yourself. There's a plethora of players. Letizier, really amazing players that had 3, 4, 6, 10 caps. Whereas now you're looking at players and you're thinking they've got 13 caps and an average player. I haven't got a point to make there, so I'm just rambling on. But I think it is interesting that there's such a difference how the England team is selected now and the amount of caps that are given to players now compared to in the 90s to early noughties.
Yeah, it's completely different. But I also admire what Gareth Southgate is doing, because he's not afraid to bring someone in. And if you like, they're almost being tested within training. And if their attitude is right, he's almost giving them that opportunity. Because what you have to realise as well is that you might sort of have a doubt about a player, but when you get him in training and then into the game, he may play and perform way above what you're expecting him to play above. And role reversal. Someone who you think is a shoo-in to go on and play for England, when the manager gets him in there, he's a bit disappointed with what he's producing. So I quite like what Gareth Southgate is doing, because he's almost giving a lot of players the opportunity, and he's just looking to see who fits in. I think also with personally with the squad, and then also with the team going forward. Listen, I don't have a problem with that. There's a lot more caps given out, but that's just the way that the modern game is. You just have to look at the period you play in, and you can't judge it to any other period, because people would say to me now, all the money that the players are earning now to what you earned is ridiculous. Yeah, but the money I earned to what they earned in the 60s and 70s is those guys would love to be earning what I earned. So I don't worry about it. You just got to try and look at it from more of in a modern way, and we can't always go back. Yes, I think you would like, from an Arsenal point of view, you would like certain traditions from the old Arsenal teams, but I think you have to try and look at what is modern and sort of try and see what's happening going forward. But that's just the way it is.
Fantastic. Nigel, thank you so much for your time. I'm just going to finish off a quick fire round. So best manager you played under?
Wenger.
Favourite film?
Breaking Bad. It's not a film, but it's a series.
Best locker room you was in?
Well, two really. Wimbledon, because it was a pub team. And then the Arsenal team, because it was so successful.
Steak or fish?
Fish.
Biggest dickhead in any squad?
Glenn Helder.
Single best game you played in?
89 Anfield.
Favourite Arsenal kit?
The old yellow one, Anfield 89. I've still got it.
The worst career, your worst moment of your career?
Being released by Ron Saunders at Birmingham.
Who wins in a fight, Paolo Di Canio or Vinnie Jones?
Vinnie Jones.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Mr. Nigel Winterburn. Thank you so, so much, Nigel. You've been absolutely one of our favourite guests yet.
No, it's not a problem, guys. Yeah. It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you. That's good. I could actually think of worse players, but as we've mentioned him, I don't know where he is. So I don't even know if he's still around. Last I heard, there was some gangs after him, but that might tell you why he came and left very quickly. Oh, I'm not saying any more.
Sports Social Podcast Network. Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.